pursue my artistic pretensions, I went first to the MFA program at Arizona, which was ghastly, and then I transferred to Columbia, which was the right program for me. And I had the one good writing teacher I've ever had in my life. And the guy's name is Philip Lope, you may have heard of. He's a well-known essayist. And I turned in some story and he yelled at me and he said, quit jumping around in time and space and you're doing the pseudo Thomas Pynchon stuff and knock it off. But he said, you know, I turned in this weird story and he said, but you really have captured the pseudo intimacy of the online world. I think you should write about that fictionally.
This time, writer and technology critic Paulina Borsuk joins John and Scoop on the Plutopia podcast. We discuss her writing career, Silicon Valley libertarians, traumatic brain injury, and her art project, My Life as a Ghost.
Hey, welcome to yet another Plutopia podcast. I'm John Lebkowski. I'm here with my pal and co-host, Scoop Sweeney. And today we're interviewing Paulina Borsuk. Paulina is a tech journalist and writer who's written for Wired, Mother Jones, and Suck.com, among many others. She's also perhaps best known for her 2000 book, Cyber Selfish, a critical romp through the terribly libertarian culture of high tech. She's also an artist with projects like My Life as a Ghost and the Hindsight Institute. And we'll be discussing, hopefully, all of that stuff today.
How can I don't know, jump up and down, entertain you guys? What do you want to talk about?
Well, I think it might be good to start with your experience as a tech journalist and how you started writing about tech and kind of how you saw your beat when you were...
That's a bit grandiose for me. But anyway, going way back, you know, I was your sort of typical Berkeley liberal arts flake. And also I'm much more out about this than I was years ago. I have traumatic brain injury, permanent. And so a lot of career paths were not available to me. Like, I didn't know why, because TBI was not understood in those days like it is now, but all that sort of typical middle-class white career paths that you think of, doctor, lawyer, engineer, you name it, brain which is short circuit. So I always had this frantic feeling, I don't know what's wrong with me. So long story short, a friend gave me a very low level clerical job at a little software company in Mill Valley, in the early middle 80s. And I had this flash of, I can do this. Now that may not sound like anything to you, but it was huge to me. I can do this. And then I also got that software is a human artifact. Oh, I can sort of figure this out if I can think about the way the person who created it was thinking about things, if that makes sense. So I did that, and then I got another job at another software company. And from there, and this was the early 80s, I was recruited to go to New York to work with Ziff Davis, which is now dead, but it was a trade magazine publisher that was getting into consumer computer magazines.
Yeah, they used to publish some science fiction magazines, as I recall,
That sounds right. So I was recruited from there, long story how that happened, to go to New York to work for a magazine, don't laugh at this, called PC Junior. Remember that ridiculous piece of hardware IBM was pushing? And that was not a good fit. The editor in chief was an old school sexist creep. He didn't like it that I'd been hired over his head. I mean, I was a Berkeley hippie. I had never been in a work environment where the boss was making stupid jokes about Charo being promiscuous and having venereal diseases. I was stunned. Anyway, so I got fired from that. But in the New York Times in those days, there was an ad for someone to be an editor at a computer magazine, really old school ads in the newspaper. So I answered it. And at that point, particularly in New York, if you'd even breathed on a computer, you probably could get a job at a computer magazine, you know, and I'd had a couple of years experience with mini computers. PCs were just not really quite coming in yet. It was a magazine called Data Communications, which in those days was probably less sexy than, like, you know, Modern Plumbing. Nobody cared about network infrastructure and nobody understood it. And Modern Plastics would have been the glamour job for McGraw-Hill. But anyway, I ended up there and I learned a lot there. I got over a lot of my writer's block because I was endlessly writing press releases, and nothing will get you over your writer's block faster than doing 25 pages a month of new products and then editing other people's stuff. But What also was true about it is that just accident, time and place, you know, I became quite friendly with Bob Metcalf, who invented Ethernet, because, you know, he was always in the offices.
Yeah, and he lives here in Austin now.
Is that where he is now? Because he wasn't mayor for a while.
He teaches at the University of Texas.
Well, good for him. Maine always didn't seem like a good fit. Then I went to the press conference at the Waldorf Astoria where Bill Gates introduced Windows. And I thought, this is just like, you know, a timeshare, like I'm used to with mini computers, but dressed up by, you know, I had this sort of, whatever. And perhaps most salient, again, accident, time and place. I ended up going to the first conference on the coming commercial uses of the net. This was in 1987. So I was immersed in all this stuff just as an accident of being a trade hog for a magazine no one had heard of, no one cared about. There was no glam, no gloss, no nothing. So that's how I got into it. And then I left there in 89 to pursue my artistic pretensions. I went first to the MFA program at Arizona, which was ghastly, and then I transferred to Columbia, which was the right program for me. And I had the one good writing teacher I've ever had in my life. And the guy's name is Philip Lopate, you may have heard of. He's an essayist. And I turned in some story and he yelled at me and he said, quit jumping around in time and space. And you're doing the pseudo Thomas Pynchon stuff and knock it off. But he said, you know, I turned in this weird little story and he said, but you really have captured the pseudo intimacy of the online world. I think you should write about that fictionally. So I did. And from there, everything spanned. You know, I wrote this very autobiographical novella, which was the first fiction Wired published called Love Over for the Wires. I wrote another one called Virtual Romance, which was nominated for a Pushcart. And then it's a long story how I got on the mailing list for the early Wired. It's because I was a very early member of the EFF, maybe number 300, long story why that is. And so I got the first issue of Wired. I thought, maybe they'll get my fiction. No one else seems to get it in New York. None of the literary magazines get this at all. So I just sent them the novella on a Friday. And on Monday, Lewis said, we'll publish it. Great. And so from then on, I was sort of, writing about technology in a literary way and understanding it from the point of view of being a liberal arts flake. I wasn't intimidated by it. I wasn't ooh and ah about it. I just thought, you know, you can write about this because it's a human endeavor. So I did that for several years. And so I would write for places like Wired, but also to keep the money coming in, I was, I do corporate hack work, but of a kind I don't feel embarrassed of, you know, white papers, technology backgrounders, what I call contented cow, happy user, application stories, you know, that kind of stuff. I'm not a good advertising copywriter. So I did that. And one of the things that I found so baffling when I got into this world was that, you know, I'd grown up in Pasadena, which is kind of Caltech, JPL, the old space program, that kind of stuff. And so people had a really different feeling about the mixture of science and technology and the government. That was the milieu I'd grown up in, right? So then I get to Silicon Valley and I'm running into these nutcase libertarians who read Ayn Rand when they were 15 and never got over it. And I thought, you wouldn't be here unless for all the government funding. What is wrong with you? And also not to mention, no one has benefited more and suffered less from the government than high tech. So I was fascinated and thought it was really weird. So then my agent, who I adore, said, well, do you have a book in you? And I said, well, I want to write about this libertarian culture of high tech because it's really weird. And he trotted me around New York and nobody in New York got it because, as one editor said to me, we don't write books about the culture of Detroit auto workers. Why should we care about the tech, you know, the culture of people working technology? This is the middle 90s. Like, you know, nobody got it. So long story short, I'm not going to get into all of that. Anyway, that's where TDB, okay, so this story is kind of amusing. So didn't get anywhere. And then I was friendly with the, you know, the NAMES Project, the AIDS quilt, right? And I was friendly with the people in San Francisco who were responsible for that. So I got invited to a party that was, which was the launch for the website for the NAMES Project. And so there I got introduced to a guy who was at Mother Jones and he said, we'd love to have you in the magazine. Do you have anything? I said, well, I've got this book proposal. Maybe you can do something with it. So I sent it off and the lovely editor took one look at it. She says, take this, turn it into a 3,000 word essay and see where we are. So I did, I sat down over a weekend, did that. They didn't change a word. They gave it the title, which is Cyber Selfish. I didn't give it that title. My title was my visit to the Hall of the Mountain Kings, because that's where the trolls guard the gold. And and so the book went through three publishers and caused me no end of aggravation and was well and widely reviewed and threw me $65,000 in debt. So that's TBB, as I call it, that damn book. And, you know, it was weird because I have no explanation for these things. The book did not sell well, though it got well reviewed. And then I was never really able to get published again. Now, I kind of felt I said what I kind of wanted to say about technology. And I can't tell you how many times in my most grumpy way, I'll feel like somebody writes something and go, yeah, I said that 5, 10, 15, 20, 25 years ago. And I didn't really want to be writing about technology anymore, but that's what I was known for. And number two, as Mark Andreessen said, software is eating the world. It became more and more pervasive. So, you know, I always had a million ideas on a zillion other projects. You know, the only one that came to partial fruition was that My Life is a Ghost art project. That, but I just kind of couldn't get anywhere. It was the weirdest thing. Now, some of it I know is being stuck in Santa Cruz. I moved here because I have a lot of health issues and I needed cleaner air, but it was very destructive for me, both professionally and personally. There's nothing here for me. There's nobody here for me. And you're really out of the flow of whatever, you know, that I was back in the Bay Area in the early 90s, middle 90s was really helpful for my career. And also for the first time, I was sort of around people like me, liberal arts flakes who'd ended up in technology and we were speaking a common language. So it's not the only thing, but I know my living in Santa Cruz sure didn't help. And then when everything kind of went kablooey after the media arc for TBB was over, I just felt shipwrecked. There's nothing here and I can't get anything started here. And, you know, and mainstream publishing, as you know, is dying. So anyway, I'll stop wanting now. Why don't you ask me a question?
Well, I don't know. Maybe you need to start a Substack. That's what everybody else is doing.
Well, I have Patreon, as you know. And you want me to talk about that at all? I don't know.
We have Patreon too, but we haven't really leveraged it very well. How is it working pretty well for you?
Well, I'm doing it like everything else I do in a very peculiar way, which is, you know, because my financial situation is quite desperate. So a friend of mine was thinking, well, why don't you try a Patreon? And of all the things that came up with, I thought, well, maybe I could try that. Now, me going into that, it's like, I'm not a blogger. I never wanted to be a columnist. Aside from assignments, I would just always write when I had something to say. So this, to me, somewhat brutal twice a month production schedule is really alien to me. And I would say I have now 2 years of my least good work. On the other hand, I have 2 years of new work and that's good. And I was looking back at some of it recently and thinking, yeah, it's not so bad. And if it had a bigger audience and I worked with a copy editor, it would not be so bad. So I'm feeling a little better about it. And it's really just a way for friends to contribute to my ongoing presence on the planet. There's really not a way to leverage it because the thing about Patreon, there are many good things about it, but it really seems to be, even if unconsciously, based on Kevin Kelly's idea of 1,000 true fans, that you go into Patreon with people already knowing a lot about you. And that was true for me at one point. It's not true anymore. And as they very clearly say, Patreon is a fan site. It's not a search site. So it's really unlikely that anybody would find me there that didn't already know me. And also, I made a certain kind of paradoxical decision with it, which is that I have been so shrieking for 25 years about, we don't have to pay you, but we'll pay you in reputation exposure. It just enrages me that no one wants to pay for anything creative anymore, whether it's photography, music, writing, just bullshit about that. So I made a very clear decision with my Patreon page that I was going to charge people real money, by which I don't mean $1,000, but which I mean, you know, they're paying, I think I have an $8 a month level and then a $25 a month level and a few more above that. And it's a lot more than you would pay these days to subscribe to The New Yorker or something, but that's because The New Yorker is desperate and downgrading what people pay for it. So how is it working out for me? I don't know. I mean, it's evolved over time. I thought initially, because I was encouraged to do this, it'd be a mixture of me kind of publishing things that I've been wanting to write about, but there's no venue. And then I've been very supportive to many friends over the last 15, 20 years when they're dealing with their parents and death and dying and aging and stuff. So people said, oh, you know, you ought to get a business out of this. And I thought, well, I don't know. I don't think it'll quite work. But I tried that initially, it didn't work. And then I was no longer tethered to writing about something about elder care, death and dying once a month. I could write it whatever I wanted. And then I also sort of, when I kind of accepted what this format is, I realized, oh, this is a place where I can write about stuff that I feel needs to be written about. Like, I wrote a very long thing, which was about my brother's true obit, as I call it, which he never got. And it's a lot about family weirdness and his life. You know, it never was published. So I wrote that. Another one for a friend of mine who died when I was 18. You know, I realize I can kind of write what I feel needs to be written. How much people like what I write, I don't know. And it always baffles me, who responds to what. I have no idea why this person really loved this and that person really loved that. It's totally baffling to me, you know?
You had that one project, Wired for Sex, which seems like it would be very commercially viable.
Yeah, you would think, wouldn't you? You know, and I had a great idea for it because the idea was talking about this in a way that could be a coffee table book that you could give it to your mother for Mother's Day, not X-rated. There's a lot of ways to talk about sexuality and have beautiful imagery, right, interesting stuff and all that kind of stuff. Well, I have some weird, someone's pronounced Netha on me and I could not get it published. I tried everything. Initially, it was gonna be with one publisher, I think Peachfit, and then they got bought by someone else and then they killed it. And then I tried marching around to various publishers, and then my agent said, oh, just, you don't have to stay with me. If you can find someone else to work out the deal for you, that's fine. I tried everywhere, John. And after a year of trying everywhere, it went nowhere. And I thought, well, I just have the curse of Paulina on me. Yeah, it would have been a fun, I would say pretty project. I just had a million cool ideas about how to do it in a way that was amusing and not arousing, for lack of a better word. You know, I think adults can do that. So that's a classic example of one that, you know, it should have. I don't know why it didn't. So anyway, I mean, My Life is a Ghost, that one's also mysterious because I was fortunate enough to be that artist in residence at Stanford. So that was something. I'm not saying it's nothing, but a couple of things. Stanford, as I snark about it, is I often consider the world's best trade school. Even though they're throwing lots of money in arts and humanities, it's basically STEM and law and medicine. And it's not really on the, the radar of kind of a lot of mainstream arts organizations. So I did it, but it didn't lead to anything. And it was one of those things where you think, you know, TBI is very much in the news right now. You would have thought I would have been able to raise money for it, but because the project is, it's not therapeutic, it's not educational. I mean, you might get that from it, but that's not what it's about. It didn't lend itself to a certain kind of fundraising. So it's just kind of there, you know, in suspended animation.
Yeah, the whole idea of getting support from people out there in the world for a project, these days it seems that it has to be a usable product.
That's right.
If you can't put it on a store shelf or you can't order it through Amazon, then it's not real.
And that's where Indiegogo really seems to have gone. It really seems, yeah, I agree with you. Or it has to be some obvious thing, like, and not that I'm against this, but, you know, to help an injured puppy. That's the other thing you can get support for. You know, some crowd-pleasing sad story. And I think people with their sad stories should be helped. I get that. But I kind of roll my eyes at it.
Well, the whole idea of getting published also, it's no longer as romantic as it once was because everyone can do it now. There used to be a pretty challenging way of getting into being a published writer or producer or artist. But now that technology has not just raised the bar but taken it completely away, everybody can be a writer, everybody can be a musician, everybody can be an artist. It may not be good, but
yeah, well, that's the
technology
part.
Made it. You know, the entry ticket is very cheap.
Right, but the thing is, what's his name? Andrew Keen wrote that book, The Cult of the Amateur. The idea that anyone can do it. And I will tell you, like with writers, for example, I read their work when it was published by some mainstream publisher, however you want it to find, and then they would go the self-publishing route because they got dropped by their publisher. And, you know, there was a real drop in quality because they didn't have a certain kind of editorial oversight. We all need it. I don't care what anybody says. We all need editors. So yeah, and also what does publishing mean at this point? And the publisher's in bad shape. And you know, I'm always whining to my friends, I can't find anything to read because so much of what gets published now, I can't stand. I don't even want to hear about another either tender memoir of maternity or recovery from addiction, or I don't know, I'm probably forgetting something, but you know, anyway, so.
So would you talk about My Life as a Ghost? You've got that sort of lead on there where you say, what happens when the soul is blasted out of the body and is incompletely returned? And yeah, that's kind of a mind-blowing concept.
It is, and I think it's sort of the, or another way of putting it, and it's also in the project, is like, it's interesting to think about that there is a repository for the soul and the brain and what happens when that gets cracked. And it's really about the mind-body problem. And I don't know if I mentioned this on the site anywhere, but I went to a very interesting conference whenever I was doing that project. Anyway, it was a conference at Santa Clara University Law School. And it's when all the foo-foo-rah was going on about football players and, you know, their brain injuries and the lawsuits. You remember when all that stuff is really active, right? And all those people there, players organizations and the lawyers, the doctors, everybody was there. And so I ended up sitting next to a woman who, she's a former jock, but she was now an attorney, Canadian, and she was an attorney for the Canadian Hockey League. Not a surprise she would be at something like this, right? So I was talking to her about my project and she just looked at me blankly and she says, oh yeah, I had a TBI and I remember the day my soul returned to my body. And I thought, I'm not crazy. This is something really interesting. Maybe 10 to 20% of people with TBI has this. And it's a way into thinking about really interesting things about the mind-body problem. What is the meaning of a self? There's just so much, it's so rich. I can't put it any other way. It's just really rich.
Well, how was it for you? I mean, you were shot in the head when you were 14, yeah, right? And right. Do you remember much about it or?
Oh yeah, I remember infinite amounts about it, but I want to make a distinction. There are two different things here. One is the cognitive things that a permanent TBI can give you, which I didn't realize at the time. And since I was a miracle, no one, and people didn't understand TBI at the time. So I cut people slack. So there were the cognitive losses. Like I was saying, I couldn't be a doctor, lawyer, engineer, anything else. The brain just did not work. And I remember looking at my high school report cards and went from all A's to B's and C's. And I remember I would just sit there and stare at stuff. And I would say now the synapses wouldn't connect. And I'd wonder what is wrong with me? And okay, so that's the cognitive stuff, but and certain other things. But the more interesting thing was the sense of I'm always partly elsewhere. And I can't explain, I don't know where that where is, but that soul is incompletely returned to the body. And what's really interesting or not, when I sent the link to this to my ex-husband, and I was with him from my middle 20s to when I was about 30, but you know, he knew me really well. And he called me and I said, hello. And he said, oh, Paulina. In other words, he had lived with someone who was in some ways never entirely there in this very subtle, metaphysical, but really basic way. So that's worth exploring. And when I got into the TBI world around the time, which I never had before, around the time of this project, and I talked to neurologists and stuff, I said, yeah, maybe about 10 to 15% of my patients talk about this, but there's almost nothing in the literature because you can't figure it out. It's a feeling, it's about consciousness, no funding for that. And there's no medical model. So there's almost no research, no funding, and you know, you can't fix it. It just is or it isn't. So I just thought it was really interesting and I thought really good art could be made around it. And I'm really sorry that it never got the funding it needed. Sorry, babbling.
Well, but you did, I mean, you did do some of the work with it. And I'm wondering kind of, I mean, I've looked at the site, but I'm wondering, like, you had a night where you actually got in front of people and talked about it. What was that like?
Well, that was very cool. What it was like is, I have a wonderful creative partner, a guy named John Rieger. And actually, we were both in philosophy undergraduates at Berkeley. And but he's like formerly a radio guy. Anyway, and so what he did, he created for me kind of like a slideshow, but there was also sound of all the stuff that was going on in this country in 1968, and particularly around Bobby Kennedy's assassination, because there's this weird tie between me and his assassination and me. And that was sort of like we projected it around the little black box theater where I was going to be performing, and it was going on in background for about, you know, because he had it on a loop for about, I don't know, half an hour of people coming in. So we had the volume low enough that you could still talk, but high enough that it would be interested. So that was going on. And then when I was up on the stage, you know, I had this sort of foundational text. I just read it, but I had a few simple props on the stage with me. And that was sort of it. And, you know, people seemed to like it. And that to me was just, she said ruefully, that was just the beginning of the project, but it never went any farther than that. I mean, it's not nothing. I'm not saying it's not nothing, but it's not something that it's was just the beginning. And the Stanford people were happy. They took a risk on me. I don't have any background as a visual artist. Why should they have done this? But I think this program that they had, which is this sort of artist in residency thing of a certain flavor, it was new and I was the first one. And if I was a total catastrophe, it didn't matter because there'd be another one coming, but they were happy with it. So,
well, if tomorrow you got unlimited amount of money, what would you do with the project?
Well, the project, and again, it's kind of stale at this point, but what I really saw it as a museum installation and almost something that you would walk through. And I had a lot of different ideas for visual representations of what that state of ghostliness is. I had ideas about, I wanted to interview other TBI ghosts. We're not that common. As I said, we're about maybe 10, 50% of people with TBI. I was sure that interviewing them, I would get ideas for how to make this experience manifest. But I really saw it as a museum installation and possibly the interviews, if I found the right TBI ghosts, you know, to make that like a 30-minute documentary is maybe too strong, but documentation of people who have this. I don't know, it's a little stale at this point, but I just think I saw this, and this is an overused word, but I saw it in a very experiential way, if that makes sense.
It sounds like it suffered from a lack of being trendy. You didn't have a Cardassian involved. You didn't have a name, a named NFL player involved. You were a normal human being with an experience that people may have been uncomfortable, you know, thinking about.
That's possibly true, except this was around the time period when there was all the stuff about the NFL. I mean, there's a lot of stuff in the news about TBI coincidentally at the time, but it just, you know, that's one of my curses. You know, I'm not, I don't ever seem to be able to capture the zeitgeist in a way that benefits me. So, I mean, yeah, anyway.
Well, capturing the zeitgeist is not one of our big things either. We tend to talk to people who are not Cardassians are famous athletes. There are people who actually, you know, can string words together either verbally or on paper, well, on whatever functions as paper these days. So,
because I had, you know, a couple of other projects that never went anywhere, but like, and there was Rocket Fall to Earth, which I was really disappointed never happened. And then I just applied for a grant, which I didn't get, for this sort of art and technology thing coming, Cryptek, coming out of Leonardo and the California Arts Council. And I just feel like, and then there's a really fun thing, which I don't know if you guys looked at, but the Hindsight Institute, did you guys look at that?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I would definitely
like to talk about that. That's very Plutopian, the Hindsight Institute. Yeah. It's the sort of thing that we resonate with very well. It looks like a very serious project.
Oh, yeah, it's very serious. Well, the thing is, the story of that is my friend Prabha, who's an artist and has academic credentials of kind I don't, she had it on her website, quite different than what you may have seen. And I went, Prabha, make me co-director, and we're going to run with this. And so I sort of, you know, dumped a whole bunch of stuff on her. We should do this, we should do that. And she loved it. But then she's been busy teaching, and also she gets grants to do stuff. So she has promised me that this summer, this will be her one creative project, because I have a zillion ideas about what to do with it. Like, I think we should have a truth and reconciliation conference. I think maybe we should have NFTs. I mean, I can just imagine a whole things where we can really run with the Hindsight Institute. And my experience is that most people find it quite entertaining, because I think we have the right tone, and she's a great visual artist, and she and I share a taste for deviltry. So I mean, I think there may even be grant money that could be thrown at it, but I've got to wait for her to free up her schedule. But I'm glad you were amused by it.
Well, it made me think about Art Mark and the Yes Men and some of those projects, if you're familiar with those.
Oh, yeah, Etoy. Etoy is the one I always had in the back of my head.
Yeah, Etoy, yeah.
Yeah, I loved Etoy. I don't know if you noticed with the books, but like I came up with the book titles and then she did these very clever things of the pricing and the page lengths for all of them. That was part of the joke. I mean, what was amusing to me about it is that some people would look at this and be confused and think it was serious. Like they didn't get that it was, you know, it was an art hack. I mean, there's no other way to call it, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
culture jamming.
Yeah, so.
Growth hacking is changing hindsight. We will be announcing changes in the summer of 2021. That's what you were talking about, that you guys were going to do some things this summer.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah. That's right. That's right. When she gets free. I mean, we make beautiful music together. What can I say? She's great. So anyway.
You know, for the benefit of people who may see a video of this, I guess I could put these up and show these books. I think the one that completely hit me was Have You Lost Your Goddamn Mind? I think you should write that book.
Well, you know, it's I suppose, but I sort of, you know, and if you notice, we've all said they're all sold out, right? So we don't have to write them.
Were shrooms involved?
Yeah.
I could give you a chapter on that.
You guys are onto something here. I think this is something that you can definitely run with.
I think so. She just has to get free, because you know I've been making lists for months of you know things I think we should do, and I don't know. I mean, I think it's needed more than ever, and anyway, I don't know what else to say about it. But I'm glad you enjoyed it. I mean, and as you can tell, one of my Patreon pieces I wrote about that whole mess with the .org. top level domain and the threat to sell it to private equity. You probably heard about all that, right?
Yeah, I remember all that. Yeah.
Yeah, I was just horrified. And I was horrified by who was coming out in favor of it. Like, my God, what admin surf? And that's where I thought, have you lost your goddamn mind? You know? But with hindsight, I can say stuff like that. So anyway, but yeah, it's so nice to have a place to. I didn't do it much, but I have written a few humor pieces over the years, like way back when and this was really early on, I wrote this really silly piece called BeverlyHills.com, really early on, about the idea of a sitcom, but with digital hipsters. It was really fun to write, or some of the pieces I wrote for Suck. Probably, what would I say is the funniest one? Probably Sex and the Singer URL, you know, the one I always titled The Cosmic Girls Guide to Dating Tech Libertarians. That one will live forever, you know? So I love doing humor, but it takes me a long time. I have to think about it, so.
Well, one that I wanted to hear more about that you mentioned in passing a minute ago was Rocket Fall to Earth. What was the idea there? What were you gonna do with that?
Oh, Rocket Fall to Earth, that was another wonderful project, I think. My oldest friend, someone I've known since I was two, her father is probably the only major scientist in the space program who hasn't had a full-length biography written of him. And he was the voice of Mission Control. He did the fundamental physics to make it so on the American side, satellites, you know, would work. But he was a really interesting guy. Like he and his Caltech roommate, they were the first people to kind of break the bank at Las Vegas because they realized that there were little imperfections in the roulette wheel, which enabled them to make a lot of money. They were banned from Las Vegas, took all their money, and sailed around the Caribbean. This was in 1949 or something like that. So her father was this incredibly brilliant, charismatic, multi-talented guy. Her mother was a very, very, very troubled woman who committed suicide when my friend was 15. And I just remember looking at this constellation, and I was just fascinated by this in a way, and I remember hearing that there are a lot of wives and girlfriends of mid-century scientists who committed suicide. I thought, what the hell is that about? And then I realized this was almost needed to be a theatrical thing, because then my friend who had been living in New York came back home to Pasadena to do the elder care thing, and I thought, there are three interesting female characters here. There's her mother who committed suicide, the very interesting stepmother, second wife, who was a very interesting character in her own life, what, right, but of a certain time and place. And then there's my friend. And then there's this difficult, charismatic father. And I just thought I could weave in Al's, you know, history with these interesting women, many of them kind of tortured. And I you know, this is one of many things that's bad about me. I write to find out what I think. I wasn't sure exactly where it was going to go, but I could sense that there was so much rich material. And I found that all these cool things about Al, just spending one day at the Huntington Library where his archives are. Like, he did really early arms control stuff, and there was a name of somebody there that we now know, but nobody in those days, Henry Kissinger. And he was looking at very early Star Wars types things. So there was so much richness here. And because he isn't as well known as, I don't know, pick somebody, it's not really been documented. And I just think also Al was charismatic, hams or whatever. My friend, I think, is somewhat on the autism spectrum and also is not this gorgeous creature the way Al was. And I always think about what is the parent-child dynamic where the parent is such a larger-than-life person and the kids are just sort of ordinary kids. That's interesting in itself. But I didn't know where it was going to go. I just looked at the richness of the characters and the richness of the backstory, and I thought, this is cool theater. I can't put it any other way.
Well, yeah, there's another thing there that occurs to me. I mean, I think about this. I've always been sort of energized by thinking about the atomic age and the original bombs, like being set off the bomb test and so forth. Yeah. And then at the same time, they were working on rockets, which were very controlled explosions. I mean, really, the history of the like mid 20th century is kind of about explosions, right?
Yeah.
The science of it. Yeah. Anyway, so Scoop, what were you going to say?
You were talking about the rockets falling to Earth, but the whole rocket world has been taken over by the mega billionaires now. You know, if you have $28 million, you can buy a 10-minute ride in space with a billionaire, and that seems to be the big story now. Instead of all these great scientists and
exactly, and
engineers.
I think about her dad with his particular mathematical gifts and everything, like he was pals with Feynman and all that kind of stuff. Is like now someone like that would just be some sort of loathsome quant hedger, God knows what. I mean, there was a project worthy of his talents, being a mid-century America working on the early days of the space program. I mean, whatever issues of him as a character, the fact is it was a project worthy of his talents. Let's just put it that way. And that was interesting. I mean, he even had a kid's science program, I think it was called Discovering, it was on every morning. I think he fly to New York every week for it? Anyway, but he had a famous science program for kids, and Leonard Nimoy loved it. And so I remember my friend had it very early, way early on before there were Trekkies. She had a little plastic model of the Enterprise in her bedroom because Leonard Nimoy had given it to her dad when he was on his show to give to his kids. So, I mean, I don't want to be a boring, everything was better when I was younger, but some ways it really was.
Well, it's anyway. True. I mean, somebody was, we were talking to somebody, I guess it was Nate Wilcox, was talking about how just after World War II, the U.S. was like, it was like a huge success. We had 3% of the world's population and something like 28 or 34% of the GDP of the world. It's like we were all born in an era when people were really kind of doing really well, and we had this great middle class and so forth. And that's all been kind of going downhill in recent years. And it's true. I think that we did have an exceptional life when we were younger. Most of us were like white middle class kids in the USA, right?
That's right. And also something that isn't talked about enough, but also relevant to this, is what we also had in the US in those days were the great industrial labs, Bell Labs, there were so many of these great industrial labs that did all kinds of cool stuff. And the bean counters were saying it's got to have commercial applicability within 6 months or, don't do it. And all kinds of cool things came out of those. Those are gone, So, I mean, that's another loss that I think we're paying the price for now. But anyway, so, another thing that I think, and I'm going to bring it up just because it ate 3 years of my life and it's really interesting. And I knew it was science and technology, but I think I sent you the thing about my moth wars, that kind of environmental activism thing that I did.
Yeah.
That was so interesting. And I learned so much about international trade policy, how agriculture does and doesn't work in this country. And it was, I'm very proud of the fact, it was probably the most successful grassroots movement I have ever seen, because it was the total libertarian dream. It was self-organizing. There was no central, you know, committee. We all did what we wanted when we wanted. We coordinated with each other when we felt like it. So consequently, the powers of the state were freaked out by us, because they thought we were really huge and we were really everywhere, but actually it wasn't quite like that. But we actually won, and we actually changed to some degree how agricultural policy works in this country. And I remember when we basically sort of won, I went to a meeting, it was held in Fresno, and they had all the guys from the farm bureaus from all over California who tend to be very conservative and agrichem oriented and stuff. And then they had a few token crunchies like me and people from the Sierra Club. And I remember the guy from USDA getting up and saying, we don't ever want to go through this kind of thing again. And so we will listen and whatever. And I thought, you know, we've moved the needle a little bit. So it was very cool. And again, that's an example of something. I could not get anything published on this anywhere. And you'd think a situation where the little people won, it was on the side of, you know, protecting the small farmer, good environmental practice, all these good things that you think we care about, I couldn't get anything published on it anywhere. It was just kind of like I am cursed. So I'm glad you found it at least somewhat interesting. So,
oh yeah. Well, it's kind of weird for them to be trying to eradicate a moth by, what were they doing? Just spraying pesticides?
I've got to back you up. It's like, this was this little Tasmanian moth, which had actually been in California for years. And it's not a threat to California agriculture. But because the California citrus community didn't want to be threatened by New Zealand and Australian citrus, they made it that this moth was going to like eat your children or something. And so those laws are in the books. This is a dangerous pest. So when coincidentally a retired Berkeley entomology professor in his Berkeley backyard found one of these in his backyard, it started all these machineries of the state going. And so it happened at the time that the California Secretary of Agriculture was a golden child of California agribusiness, was phobic about invasive species. So he wanted to use this moth as a showcase for using pheromone-based pesticides, aerially spraying, ground spraying, and stuff like this. And, you know, he was an undergraduate in Berkeley, which if nothing else meant that he spent 4 years in the kind of place Berkeley is. And he should have realized all the rich limousine liberals Marin County, San Francisco, and Berkeley are not going to put up with being aerially sprayed. And they have the brains and they have the connections and they have the money one way or another to stop this. Like he didn't realize that he was not dealing with the Central Valley, where the poor farm workers have to put up with whatever junk is thrown at them. So it was interesting and fascinating. I could go on about it for hours, but I found it thrilling that it actually worked. It was the kind of citizens movement we all dream of and never happens. And I will say, the last time I saw people this activated was during the Vietnam War. But what was also weird about it is that I had friends in the Bay Area who had no idea this was even going on. I thought, how did you miss this? It was all over the media. There was all these bumper stickers. We had marches across the Golden Gate Bridge. I mean, you know, we had the kind of media coverage and everything else coverage that you would die for. And if you weren't in that zone, you didn't know anything about it. And I thought, wow, even then, and this is like 10, 15 years ago, the media world was so, what's the word, fractionalizing? Anyway, you know what I'm trying to say, balkanizing. So.
Yeah, this makes me think about, like when Scoop and I were kids in West Texas, they had these DDT trucks, you know, drive around and fog the neighborhood, and the kids would get on their bicycles and ride behind the truck in the fog, you know. Of course, we'd hold our breath, but God knows what happened to us. What, our chromosomes are probably kind of weird.
Well, you held your breath, but I didn't. I loved the smell of DDT in the morning.
Right.
It smells like victory.
That smelled like West Texas. See, speaking of Texas, Monsanto and Bayer are in a big lawsuit now by the vineyards in the Texas Panhandle, which is a big wine growing area. They came out with this grand pesticide to help the cotton growers in the Panhandle, but the vineyards are all dying because, you know, this, you know, patented seed and pesticide combination they sold to all of the cotton farmers, all that's drifting into the vineyards and killing all the vines. So that was the big news today, that they are getting all these farmers and ranchers who wanted to be wine growers. They're getting upset, and it's the usual suspects, Bayer and Monsanto.
That's right. That's right. And pesticide drift often is like 5 miles. So, in California, the laws, they have some laws like there has to be like a mile buffer area between where you might be spraying and a school. But we all know it can drift up to 5 miles. So, yeah, I mean, it was one of those things where I felt called to do this, and I was obsessed with it for 3 years, and then we won. But then there was kind of a couple kinds of postpartum depression. It's like, now what? I mean, stopping something isn't as glorious as creating something. And then obviously I didn't feel like I wanted to go on having a life as an eco-activist. I mean, that is a box definitely ticked. I really done a lot for sustainable ag and the environment, but I don't want a career in it. And also it was unusual again, because we all just did what we wanted. And if I tried to, any other issue that come up, then you have to deal with other people's agendas. Anyway.
Were you in the Bay Area and when they were spraying for the medfly?
Oh, Malathion. Yes.
Yes. I lost the paint job on my new car.
I heard
the first time I'd had it was new to me. It was a used car, but it had a nice paint job, which immediately went away after the medfly spray did its deed.
And it doesn't even work. I mean, there's a lot of arguments you made that medfly is not that dangerous, and it's always here anyway, and these eradications programs don't work. I mean, I learned so much about life science and bugs and life cycles. I mean, it was fascinating. I like that kind of stuff. But yeah, I was around when that was going on. And, if it does that to the finish of your car, think about what it might be doing to your mucous membranes,
Yeah, exactly. And it's always the usual suspects involved. Whenever there's something that is perceived as a crisis, the chemical companies jump right in with a new wonder chemical of some sort that is supposed to save us all, and seldom does.
One of the things that I begin to understand in this is a lot of the farmers or whatever, they kind of come from a different mindset and a different era, and that kind of like almost like a public health mindset. Like, we eradicate the mosquitoes and people will be safe. And since there was an initial success with the DDT-like pesticides after World War II, they keep on thinking it's like that, where we in sustainable ag circles have a different model, which is you create healthy plants, healthy soil, and a little bit of loss to insects is not going to be catastrophic. It's a very different model. Our model of a healthy-looking field has got lots of insects buzzing around it. Theirs is one which is sterile-looking. But they really have that mindset that's kind of left over from the public health mindset of the early 20th century of, let's eradicate mosquitoes. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, we've seen that public health has imperfections.
Oh, yeah.
We watched this whole thing where throughout this global pandemic, they had an evolving understanding. And you could really see, that was really kind of a pure science kind of thing, because you were seeing that science is just, you offer a hypothesis and it may fail, and then you may have to offer a different hypothesis. And we went from thinking that we needed to wash our groceries to realizing we just needed to wear masks, right?
Right.
So, before we run out of time, one thing I really wanted to talk to you about, kind of getting back to cyber selfish. You had some very strong, I guess, opinions about the libertarians that were creating what we now refer to as big tech.
Yeah, right.
And I'm just kind of wondering what your thoughts are about how that has evolved since then. Or do you, are you paying any attention to it now?
Well, you can't avoid it.
It's hard to, yeah.
I mean, I think my original thesis still stands, which is, why do these people think they're immune from any kind of regulation or anything else? And why do they feel so fragile? I mean, the whole thing of Peter Thiel going after Gawker, which I thought was insane. In other words, how do these people get so fragile? Because that's sort of what this is. And why do they feel so embattled? Beleaguered, which, is the opposite of how the rest of us perceive them. So, yeah, I've been watching it, and, I kind of sit there and I go, yeah, I told you so. a lot of people have written all about this stuff really smartly, but one thing I wanted to say, which is about Julian Assange, which is that you know, as a young person, he was on the cypherpunk list, right?
I recall.
And I thought, you know, because when he first came along, I thought, wow, he seems like a real life cypherpunk hero. But he was the first person to realize that corporate bad behavior was as much going to be a problem as the government bad behavior. And I will always give him credit for that, even though we have a lot of mixed feelings about him at this point. So, I mean, and that's where you,
Oh, I was just going to say, there's some kind of weird confusion around who the good guys are and who the bad guys are now, because, you know, it's sort of like when I, in the 60s, when I was hanging out with people who were political activists, they were really down on the FBI.
Right.
And, you know, there's political activists now who are down on the FBI, but they're not on the left like those guys were. They're on the far right.
I know. It's all a mess.
It is a mess. And really, you don't know who the good guys are anymore, because, you know, when you think about it, some of the people that the people on the right now are complaining about have, you know, or agencies and organizations, deep state, whatever, they have a history of doing some bad things. But these new guys who are in, they also have a recent history of advocating some very bad things. And, you know, maybe there's no good guys. I don't know. Maybe we're just all bad
guys. I can agree with that. And I also, and I know this is an extremely unpopular opinion, but I am very, very, very uncomfortable with cancel culture. I tend to be a free speech bigot and fanatic. And I don't necessarily like it. The ACLU is taking on social justice issues as opposed to defending civil liberties. Now, I know that's a really unpopular opinion, but I don't like how far left meets far right on these things, because they're both kind of anti-democratic, it seems to me. But that's maybe not a road we want to go down in this. So.
Well, you talked about the desire of the big tech companies to avoid regulation and oversight. And we're seeing the impact of that here in the Austin area, because all those guys are moving here because they they see that we have a very right-wing, anti-regulation government in Texas. So it's like, well, they're going to heaven now. They finally found a place where, you know, the word regulation is a dirty word.
Yeah, our government really froze us to death because of their distaste for regulation.
I saw that. But, you know, when I was doing, you know, the Patreon site's about 2 years old, and people say, oh, you're writing about stuff after the Trump. I go, no, there are a million other people who can write about Trump. I don't need to contribute to that noise. There's a million other smart people writing about it. The closest I came to writing anything having to do with any of this is, I don't know if you remember, but several months ago, there was a nitwit right-wing commentator who was going after Biden's old dog and saying he looked like a junkyard dog. It was the most ridiculous thing. So I did kind of a deep dive about who that guy was, the law firm, the anti-defamation law firm that went after him. In other words, I did a really deep dive in that, because it was so absurd and no one else, aside from me, was willing to do the deep dive, look into it. But that is the closest I've ever done to do anything about politics. Because I don't, you know, there's a million other people to do that. That's not me. I have to write about what seizes my imagination, such as it is. I don't know.
Well, there seems to be a prevailing belief now that you have to be political, or, you know, that you have to identify with some political party or position or whatever. And, you know, for years I was pretty apolitical. I got drawn into politics and some degree of activism because of, I guess it was when George Bush was president, George W. Bush, and certainly Trump, you know. But I was opposed to Trump. I wasn't opposed to Republicans, or, you know, not necessarily opposed to conservatives, but I am opposed to crooks. And I'm opposed to fascists, and I'm opposed to, like, the far right. The far left has issues too. Extremism. I'm kind of opposed to extremism. And
I totally agree with you. And also, I just have to, because I'm always going on about this, the ahistoricity of everything drives me crazy. And the people on the right throw these terms around: socialist, communist, Nazi. They don't even know what those words mean. And just to bring it back to technology a little bit, about 5 years ago, I just gave a talk at Princeton in their graduate computer science things, the seminar. And I just talked a little bit about the history of the technology and all this, you know, just, you know, kind of the kind of thing that I do. And these kids, I couldn't believe them. They knew nothing about any of this. They'd never been obliged to take a class on the history of technology or technology and society. They didn't know anything about anything, and they were totally hungry for it. And one of the kids came up to me later and said, all I ever heard about was John von Neumann and Bill Gates, and that's about it. And I was like, ugh, God. Anyway, that's one of my pet peeves, is people who, I love history, people who don't know their history and don't know the meaning of words. I know it's an obvious thing, but since you're interviewing me, I have to plug for that, so.
Maybe you should write a play. We had Abby Pine in an interview yesterday. She has been writing plays, and she says she's writing a play now about young Bill Gates, and really about Bill Gates versus the open source movement, sort of.
I find Bill Gates so deeply uninteresting. He's just the Jay Gould of our era, and he's, you know, kind of immoral and kind of ruthless, and like, you know, I don't. I mean, I'm glad she's doing it. He is not someone who would have captured my imagination. So I don't know. I mean, again, and this is a bottom line for me, and this has been one of my struggles with Patreon. It's very weird for me not to have an audience, because back in my MicroStar days, you know, I would have a readership of tens, sometimes even hundreds of thousands of readers. And because it was published, it would go on to get read. It's really weird to be writing into a vacuum. So given some of these failed projects, which are failed, stillborn projects that I've had, I'm very reluctant to starting on another project that may never see the light of day. I know that seems weird, but I do. I mean, there, you know, that whole thing, if a tree falls in the forest and there's no one there to hear it, it doesn't make a sound. I have a performative aspect to my character as a writer. I need to be read or heard or something. And so I'm not much inclined to start on another project, that particularly when, you know, Rocket Fall to Earth, Berkeley Rep has an incubator program. And so I submitted to it and I didn't even make the first cut. So I thought, okay, done. I don't know. I mean, I appreciate the suggestion, but you understand why I'm very wary of putting myself out there in a certain way again. Does that make sense?
So what are you working on now? Just Hindsight?
Well, Hindsight, one project gets done. And let's not minimize that I'm cranking out 2 Patreon texts a month, which is not a small thing for me.
True, and, understood.
You know, so I posted one about 2 weeks ago, and I've got another one ready to go. But for some reason, the one I posted 2 weeks ago, a lot of people are reading it. Why? I don't know. So that is my main creative thing, is keeping up with the Patreon production, because I'm not a natural blogger or columnist, so that's no small thing. And I'm also, don't laugh at me, I'm an Airbnb super host. I never thought that's what I'd be doing with my life. So that takes up a lot of time to some degree. So
anyway. No, I can relate to that. I've been there. We actually did some of that ourselves. That's hard work.
Well, it is. I mean, it's not that bad. It just means you've got to pay attention. And there's a big house that I have to stay on top with. And, you know, because of the wildfire danger around here, I had to rip out a bunch of stuff and put it in a hard, never mind. It's just, we're living in a high wildfire zone. So there's a lot of stuff doing that. So anyway, so I feel bad that I don't have any amazing new projects for you, but the Patreon text twice a month is not a small thing. And then I'll be dealing with Hindsight and probably get back to me, which I hope is soon. And, you know, I don't know where that will take us, because, you know, I'm brimming full of ideas about what we can do with it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. We're going to be watching it. We want to have you back, maybe with your colleague who's working on it with you.
Well, probably. Maybe well, we should... first, she's got to get back in touch with me and have free time. But yes, we are, what is it, folia de, we contribute to each other's wickedness, if you want to call it that. So, because she tends to be much more traditional lefty, you know, Latina, queer, very politically engaged art, and I just tend to be more of a snot cake. So, but you know, we adore each other, so it works. Well, it was good talking to you guys, and because
yeah,
I was
this
thinking,
has been a great conversation.
Well, so much of it, I was afraid it's all my old stuff, but I guess I still have things to say. So, anyway, all right, absolutely. Great to see you again, and
yeah, thanks so much for joining us.
You can follow the Plutopia News Network at plutopia.io. On Facebook, go to @PlutopiaNews. On Twitter, it's @Plutopia. With John Lepkoski, I'm Scoop Sweeney. This is the Plutopia News Network, 20 minutes into the future.